We just can't believe what we just saw.
Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. With your host, Joe Manko. Yahoo Sports is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Oh, it's going in. Right now.
Ole, 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 ole. Ole, ole.
This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago. And we really are just processing what we all just witnessed in the Champions League. Barcelona overcame a 4-0 first leg deficit against PSG. And really, it was the greatest comeback in soccer history and maybe in sports history. And that's where we're going to start this podcast. I'm here in the Playa Vista podcasting room with Shahan Ahmed, Alex Baker, and Leander Scharlakens. And Leander, for your recap of this game, you did call it the greatest comeback in soccer history. Why do you feel so strongly about this? I think I'm all in agreement with it because I've never seen any team overcome, produce improbable 3 goals in the last 7 minutes, and it was just improbable. It was just, you didn't think they were going to pull it off. But your thoughts on what Barcelona just accomplished?
I thought it was extraordinary. I mean, 4-0 down against Paris Saint-Germain, you're not supposed to still be in that game. I mean, as you recall, 3 weeks ago, we were all talking about, is this the end of the Barcelona dynasty? And then Luis Enrique goes and announces that this is going to be his final season. And we're all just wondering how long it's going to take Barca to reset, to rebuild. Are they going to reload? You know, we were all kind of spinning the story forward already and considering it a fait accompli that this was over, that this was done with. And, you know, they get out to a quick 2-0 lead. You think, all right, they're halfway there. This might happen. And then they get the third goal. Right after halftime when Messi scores that penalty, and you think it kind of felt like an inevitability at that point that Barca would equalize and it would be 4-4, and either they'd get the fifth or go to extra time. But then Cavani scores for PSG. I think, all right, it's over now. It's the away goal. Twitter really was talking mostly about whether the away goal rule should be done away with because it sort of ruins games like this. And so, again, it was kind of assumed that it was over. And then, you know, this lasts until the 88th minute. And then we get the 88th minute free kick from Neymar, the 90th minute penalty from Neymar, and the 95th minute winner from Sergio Roberto. It should be noted on an assist from Neymar, who was huge because he also won that penalty that Messi scored on. But I just can't recall a game like that. I mean, the famous Istanbul final when Liverpool came back against AC Milan was incredible, but they weren't down quite so far as Barcelona was because, again, PSG is a really good team. They have good players in every position. They have two good players in every position. You could argue there might be a deeper team than Barcelona is right now, and this just wasn't supposed to happen. And I was actually researching this a little bit, and somebody on Twitter, Mohamed Moalem, looked it up, and he said there were only 4 clubs that have overturned a 4-goal first-leg deficit in a UEFA competition. Lechaus in 1962, Partizan in 1984, and Real Madrid in 1985. And of course, Barcelona is the latest. But I don't think the stakes were ever as high, and I don't think the opposition was ever as strong as when Barca has done it. So that's what I think makes this the greatest comeback in Champions League history.
Shahan, would you agree with that? We were watching the game, and as soon as it was done, we all thought Istanbul, but then we realized that happened, you know, that was another 3 goals in quick succession, but there was still a lot of time left for them to get those goals. This was insane. We were watching up in our newsroom, and we had product managers behind us watching the game. This is a moment where, you know, you don't have to be a soccer fan to appreciate this. Sports fans in general here in our office were like, what is going on?
Yeah, that was incredible. I mean, there's no way other than we were all just at a loss for words. People like Leander, who had to write off the game story, were rewriting everything in the last, you know. I mean, the way that match finished, because the second Cavani scored, you thought, uh-oh, these guys, you know what? There's no way Barcelona's scoring 3 more goals in the final 30 minutes. And then you kind of look around and you say, wow, you know, Cavani gets in on a one-on-one. He almost scores. Incredible save by Ter Stegen. Di Maria gets in on a one-on-one. seemed like Mascherano may have fouled him, but he gets away with it, which Mascherano has a habit of doing if there was a foul. Regardless, there were two goals that PSG could have scored and completely put this match to bed. And then those last 7 minutes, I mean, you know, that free kick, the fact that Neymar even stepped up and took it, because it very well, normally you'd be like, okay, I understand it's on the right side, but it's Messi, free kick around the goal. You probably will give it to him. Neymar puts it upper left corner, perfect. Then there's a penalty one, Suarez dive, granted, but normally Messi would step up, and Messi already made a penalty kick earlier. Neymar steps up to the spot, drains it, easy to the right of the keeper. And then to have the ability to put in that pass, I mean, he took the free kick, ball comes back out, Neymar gets it, and then drops in a perfect ball to Sergio Roberto, who, by the way, did not start today when Barcelona went three in the back. He came on as a substitute. So the right back hitting the match winner, which if it was Dani Alves, we'd be like, of course it's Dani Alves. But for it to be Sergio Roberto, actually, I think means a little bit more. But yeah, that was the best comeback that I can think of. And, you know, it rivals, if you want to go to other sports, it rivals the 3-1 comeback that the Cavs pulled off. The Patriots, obviously, that we've talked about. Really, any comeback in any sport ever. Because to score three goals against a team of that caliber in the last 7 minutes, and that includes stoppage time. We're not saying, you know, 7 minutes plus stoppage time. It was the 80th minute, the 90th minute, and the 95th minute in a match that was only scheduled to go 5 extra minutes of injury time. They scored right before those 5 minutes were up. It's incredible.
Alex, so Barcelona was down 4-0 going into this second leg. And we had talked if there was a team that was going to come back, ever come back from this type of deficit in a Champions League knockout stage right. game, it's Barcelona. But even, you kind of had, like what I was saying, we're kind of obliged to say that because of Barcelona, what they've done, you know.
It's sort of lip service.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think, you know, what you're saying about the newsroom really speaks to this. And the fact that this has been a year where we've seen comebacks and all the major American sports finals with the Cavs, with the Super Bowl, and with the World Series, with the Cubs.
The Cubs coming back.
The fact that it could still turn that many heads in the cynical, smoke-filled halls of Yahoo Sports, how many people are going to look up from their keyboards and be astounded by this, because it really was astounding. And I think, you know, it's part of the reason that we love the sport is that it can deal you unexpected things like this. And you know, Neymar is a guy who not very long ago we were asking the question, what's wrong with the guy? Sergio Roberto is a guy who I've heard in the last week is maybe not of the caliber of a Barcelona player, but these guys did the impossible today, and you got to give them, sure, they had a little help from the ref maybe, but you got to give them credit.
There are two things that I want to really, you know, harp on. One is when Luis Enrique made his announcement that he was stepping down at the end of the year, including that game, which was against Sporting Gijón, and the two games that have followed, which includes PSG, Barcelona has scored 17 goals and only allowed two. In three matches, 17 goals. That's insane. So some credit to the manager for the fact that he clearly reinvigorated his squad and got the best out of them following that announcement. The other thing I just kind of have to harp on is that I think Unai Emery got it completely wrong today. You looked at the average positions, you know, even at halftime, and I would say every single Barcelona player, maybe you would say, you know, Piqué or Mascherano was on the halfway line, but every Barcelona player was in PSG's half. They were holding the ball. The possession was happening entirely in PSG's half. And then every PSG player was in their own half. You know, even when they had the chances where you would say, okay, quick counter, lightning. No, none of that. Because Cavani was also sitting back and having to track back and cover. So even if they got possession, they pretty much just booted it or just lost it entirely. Like in a second. It was not really competitive from the standpoint of we're a team that won 4-0. We can go to your home and we can score goals. Even the goal that came and those chances that I talked about late, those kind of came about after they put Di Maria on, which Di Maria was arguably the best player in that first leg. How do you not start that guy? And I like Lucas Moura. I think he's a good player, but that team definitely could have used some of that outlet, the ability to counter. And I think they would have scored more than one goal if Di Maria ends up starting.
I think there's a big elephant in the room though, guys. Neymar, before he went on sort of his heroic late bender of two goals and an assist, probably should have been sent off because he kicked out at Marquinhos in a way that was a red card. And he got a yellow, which means the referee saw it. And that really wasn't the first dubious decision of the game. And you kind of hate to conclude that that the game was influenced by bad refereeing, but it was because, you know, Angel Di Maria was taken down late in the game, should have had a penalty, inexplicably wasn't given one. When Suarez earns that late penalty, he dove, as Shahan said, I believe. When Neymar won that early penalty or the earlier penalty that Messi scored on, that was a pretty soft penalty. I do think it was a penalty. You know, there were a few things there where, you know, the one of those calls goes the other way and Paris Saint-Germain is through to the quarterfinal.
Yeah, I will say the Barcelona Champions League referee conspiracy lives on, and it's something that, you know, it's a part of the fabric of Barcelona in the Champions League at this point. It comes up every time, and yes, they got some favorable calls, but even with those favorable calls, I mean, Neymar still has to hit that free kick to the upper left corner. They still have to drop that pass in for Sergi Roberto, of all people, to get his foot to it, to be onside, which he was onside. That was the right call as well. I think there was a lot going on in that match, and still, to put up 6 goals under any circumstances against PSG.
And there were the requisite Cavani missed wide open opportunities. He had one off
there
the
were
post.
A couple. There were a couple.
But what a goal he did strike, though. The outside of the foot, that was a reminder of what a top-class forward Cavani is when he does get it right.
Can I go on a quick pro-Cavani rant here? Because this has been...
Oh, I knew that. I knew it was coming.
You know, he's been seen as this incredibly wasteful striker, and he does occasionally miss comically. But the guy makes such good runs, and he's such a good target man, and he gets himself in a position that, you know, three-quarters of the chances that he misses that he probably should score, I don't know that any other striker in the world would get to them. Edinson Cavani is one of the three best strikers in the world, I think, along with Luis Suarez and Robert Lewandowski, and he just gets no credit for it. And that ball off the post, most guys wouldn't have gotten to it. The one-on-one he probably should have scored on, but that goal that he did score was an incredible finish. I have so much love for Cavani, and he seems to really be shortchanged. He might be one of those players that we don't appreciate until after his time.
I didn't realize that Cavani played for Ajax. I thought that was Luis Suarez.
All right, moving on.
So with Barcelona's through to the quarterfinals, where do we place Barca now when we look at the title favorites? Do you elevate them back to what we thought they were before this 4-0? They fell behind 4-0 to PSG after the first leg, or how do we see Barcelona after all this?
So going into the tie with PSG, I didn't think Barcelona was playing particularly well. I thought that they had a lot of deficiencies. I thought they had a lot of mistakes, a lot of faults, and frankly, they didn't really know who to play and who their right guys to play were. After that first leg, you thought that there was no way that this team could advance. Just they're basically dead in the water. After the second leg, you have to say that this team, there's no reason that this team could not just advance and beat anybody in Europe. I think Neymar is playing out of his mind. Messi being more central seems to be combining well with Neymar. I thought PSG, one of the few things they did do was recognize that coming into the match and clearly cut off the Neymar and Messi connection. But Messi was still able to get on the ball. Neymar was still able to get on the ball when they needed to. The right, you know, they've incorporated Rakitic and Rafinha in particular seems like something that I think Rafinha's service wasn't always at its best, but he had the ability to get up and down the line. The three in the back did work to have Mascherano, Umtiti, and Piqué all playing. I think that might be the way that they go about it in Europe. You know, the 3-4-3, the three in the back seems to be working in Europe this year. Seems to be a special year for that. So I think that this is one of those instances where coming into the quarterfinals, I would not bet against them, and I think right now they're in position to do another treble, as crazy as that sounds.
The funny thing about this season for Barca is that really the turning point was that 4-0 loss to Paris Saint-Germain on Valentine's Day, no less. I mean, after that, they got a win against Leganes with a 90th-minute Messi penalty, and then they squeaked out that win over Atletico Madrid, and then they went on a roll with their 6-1 and 5-0 wins at home against Gijon and Celta Vigo. And of course, now this 6-1 win against Paris Saint-Germain. And it seems like maybe, You know, if you look at their season, from November until January, they were dropping a lot of points in the league, and they were sort of inefficient, and there were a lot of, they had 4-1-1 ties over that stretch. And, you know, maybe this just kind of woke them up and said, you know, this isn't one of those Barcelona seasons where you can just cruise through the whole thing and just kind of get started with playing well in April or May. You know, you need to get it together. You don't have that dominant a team anymore. So in a way, that 4-0 loss was kind of helpful.
Do you think the 4-0 loss and all the heat that Luis Enrique took after that, and then Luis Enrique announced that he's going to leave after the 2-1 win, oddly, after a 2-1 win over Atletico Madrid, that the pressure was off Luis Enrique, that he went to this 3-4-3 after the win over Atletico, if the story that I read was correct. And then they win 6-1 over Sporting Gijón, 5-0 over Celta Vigo. And it seems like, to me, that Enrique just said, look, this is what's going to get us there past, get us by PSG. We need to control that midfield. We'll throw an extra guy up there. It leaves us vulnerable in the back. But this is the only way we're going to... And it worked for the first half, then Cavani scores, and then the madness at the end. But it just seems like Luis Enrique deserves some credit for adjusting things to set them up for this type of comeback.
Yeah, he changed the narrative of the season. It seemed like everything was turning negative a little bit. And the second he made that announcement, they just started smashing teams. They started scoring goals again. And yes, the adjustments he made, he deserves all the credit. You know, after that first leg, I remember I went off on the fact that he didn't play Messi on the right side. He played him in that number 10 role. And I said, I don't know what the heck he's doing. In that match, he had Andre Gomes playing the right side. And that guy had a nightmare. It was one of those games to forget. It didn't work because he couldn't really do anything going forward. And he wasn't quite the right guy to even go backwards. He just kind of stayed and didn't really maintain possession, didn't really advance the ball. I think Luis Enrique made the right adjustments by reintroducing Rakitic and Rafinha in particular. Those two guys made all the difference in the world. I didn't think that Iniesta would get the start. I wasn't sure if he would. But I think that Enrique made the right decision. Eventually, you know, he did bring on Roberto and took off Iniesta. But I think that did play into it. I think Luis Enrique deserves all the credit in the world for, frankly, salvaging the season over a three-week period where they've pretty much went from completely having their worst exit in the Champions League, I think, in a decade is what it was looking like, to now being in the quarterfinals. And after achieving that, I wouldn't want to play Barcelona.
They might win the treble.
That would be the third treble. And it would be the perfect way to bookmark Luis Enrique's three-year spell. Only 3 years. If he does the treble, wins a double, and then wins a treble again, forget Pep Guardiola. I mean, honestly, it's Luis Enrique would go down. If you just, you know, divorce yourself from the fact that the fans don't necessarily give him all the love he really deserves, you divorce yourself from that fact and just look at his results, his trophies. The man, if he'll go out as a complete, absolute legend and arguably the best manager Barcelona's had over a three-year spell if he's able to pull this off.
Yeah, I think you got to see Barcelona as favorites. And I know a couple of weeks ago, none of us did. But based on what we've seen this week, I know Bayern had a big win. But, you know, that's against an Arsenal side that we don't even want to get into right now.
Oh, we want to get into it, but just not right this second.
It's another podcast.
It's almost a podcast in itself. Real Madrid, I know, got through, but not as convincingly as Barca. But I was going to say about Enrique, it kind of reminds me of Jupp Heynckes a couple of years ago when he found out that Guardiola was coming in and he announced his retirement, and suddenly that Bayern side just picked up and just started kicking ass and taking names, if I can say that, and what, yes, a trouble. So I think that maybe there is some kind of abandon that comes with knowing that this is not going to be his problem next season, and I don't know, these guys are motivated to play for him, that's for sure. They want to send him out on a high.
So let's talk about PSG. What are the ramifications? What are the repercussions of blowing becoming on the wrong side, ending up on the wrong side of history after leading 4-0 after the first leg, and you lose 6-5 on aggregate, conceding three times in the last 7 minutes? Where is the psyche? Where does this leave PSG? Not just for this season, but in their ambitions to be a Champions League winner.
Well, Unai Emery came into PSG with the direct goal of advancing this team in Europe. I mean, they'd been knocked out of the quarterfinals, if I'm correct, pretty much, what, 3 years in a row? And, you know, whether it was Ancelotti or Laurent Blanc, it was time to kind of progress past that. And after winning 4-0 in the first leg, you thought that, okay, even though this team is second in Ligue 1, they're still in position to advance. And really, they should have been advanced. And I think he kind of blew it. If they go in there with an attacking mindset, they play Di Maria from the start. If they kind of come into this match really trying to do what they did in the first leg and attack Barcelona, there's no reason to believe that they wouldn't be able to score. Because even if you watch Barcelona last weekend, there were chances there. Even if you watch Barcelona for the last half hour, there were chances that they give up the way that they play. They can score goals now, and they're scoring goals regularly, but they definitely give up chances at the back. So I thought that they set themselves up. If you're sitting in the back and the ball is just being played around your box, eventually you're going to step in and there's going to be questionable calls. There's going to be calls that are not questionable, but you're going to give up fouls. You're going to give up penalties. You're putting yourself in that position where you're kind of vulnerable to the referee's whistle, which is what ultimately happened on a couple occasions and cost them. I think Unai Emery being second in Ligue 1 and losing in the round of 16, his job is not safe all of a sudden, which is not something I would have said a week ago or 2 weeks ago. Frankly, after that 4-0 against Barcelona, you thought for sure his job is safe. But now, no, there's no reason to think that he's for sure coming back.
If you look at Paris Saint-Germain's record in the Champions League over the last 5 years, they've had terrible luck as well. They made it to four straight quarterfinals. But in 2013, they played Barcelona. The next year, they played Chelsea. The next year, they played Barcelona again. Last year, they played Manchester City. And this year, of course, they played Barcelona in the round of 16. That's a really terrible track record. It's a little bit like the way Manchester City in its first few years in the Champions League was always getting these awful, awful draws in the group stage. Nonetheless, that does tend to have a cumulative effect on a club's sort of sense of self-esteem, I think, where, you know, you kind of become Arsenal after a little while. And again, we'll get to that. Where, you know, you're always going out in the round of 16.
Ouch.
You know, you're never winning the Premier League, etc. And it just becomes kind of this mental block where and it's really hard to shake that. You almost need to start over with new players and a new to be able to really exercise these demons. But you can't really do that on a short turnaround. So I don't know what the solution there is.
But this is a big team. We're not talking about some underdog team. We're talking about one of the richest teams in the world. They should be able to go up against these teams that Leander's talking about and match them. And today, they did not come to match Barcelona. They played defensively. They sat back. They didn't make a third of the passes that Barcelona completed. They conceded possession. So I have to agree with Shahan that I think Unai Emery, I think, was just really naive to think that they could just go there and hold a four-goal lead. Against most teams, yeah, you can. And I know we said it was a bit of a lip service to say that you can against Barca, but they couldn't do it against Barcelona.
Do you think a sad but giggling Alexis Sanchez will solve any of the problems for PSG? How's that for a segue to Arsenal?
Wow. I hear they have great dog parks in Paris.
So to switch it over to a disappointing and sad Frenchman, Arsene Wenger, watched his Arsenal lose 5-1 again to Bayern Munich in the second leg of their Champions League round of 16 tie. And guys, if this is not rock bottom for a very proud, once very proud club in England, I don't know what is. The scenes before the game with the banners, the anti-Wenger banners, and then the absolute collapse after Laurent Koscielny's red card, where it looked like the players had given up. I mean, Bayern had four guys running in on goal, and I think maybe one Arsenal guy was running back. You know, Alexis Sanchez is laughing, giggling on the bench. Arsene Wenger incredulously thinks, paints this rosy picture in his post-game presser. And the fans, you know, they're chanting, "You're killing our club," you know, toward the end of the game. It's not a pretty scene for Arsenal. I mean, how does the club handle this situation? What is the best solution right now with everything so tense, so ugly right now around the club?
before I cede the floor to Alex, because I really want to hear what he says, but I'm just wondering why Joey Gallino isn't here. Did he call in sick again after a terrible Arsenal result?
That, I think that was his excuse, but he did tweet at us saying that he wanted to do his own podcast with Alex over a bottle of scotch.
I believe there will be a lot of tears in that podcast. I'm going to have to waterproof the mics on that one.
Tears and breaking glass?
Well, you know, we've heard over the years that this is like a new level of frustration with Wenger, but I do feel like that this one really has crossed a line. And I was listening to TalkSport this morning, and some of the Gunners who were calling in, just the absolute vitriol and venom and bile they have for Wenger in England right now. They are calling for his head in a way that I've never quite heard before. And you don't really hear fans or people defending him. And I think that his position has become pretty much indefensible because, okay, they went down a man, yes, but you can go down a man without giving up five goals. You can go down a man without capitulating. You can lose 3-1 or 2-1 or something. But as you said, they just gave up. They gave up. And it became very hard to watch. And I found myself sort of looking away and wanting to kind of do other things. And not even really, there's just no belief in this team. And yeah, Bayern Munich is one of the best teams in Europe, certainly, but far better man per man than Arsenal. But if Arsenal really is a big club and really, really wants to stake its claim that it belongs at the table with these big clubs in the last 16 of the Champions League or beyond, then I think it's just not good enough. And you have to put that down on Arsene Wenger. If you look at the 10 years since Barcelona beat Arsenal in the Champions League final, and you look at what Barcelona has kicked on to do, and you look at Arsenal, they've backslid. They've gone backwards. And you have to pin that on the management.
The right team went through. They lost 5-1 in Munich. They lost 5-1 at home. That was the worst home defeat in the Emirates since it opened. If this isn't rock bottom, I don't know what is rock bottom. I mean, the fifth goal, like we said, they didn't even try and run back after seeing the offside flag not go up. They like raised their hands a bunch of times. They looked over. It didn't go up, and they still didn't run back. Alexis on the bench laughing at that fifth goal. Like, okay, you can say that it was a smile. He wasn't entirely laughing. He covered his face a little bit. You could argue that maybe it was, but you know what? It didn't look like a guy who was upset or angry. It looked like a guy who was basically like, he almost breathed a sigh of relief. It looked like it was very odd. Okay, for a guy who has been probably the only guy who gets upset, it was almost one of those things like, oh, great, like not my problem, which very well might not be his problem very soon. And, you know, as much as people may want to say, wait, why did they take him off? Are you kidding me? That was the only thing Wenger got right in that game. They weren't going to come back. Why use him and save him for the weekend? Save him for when you actually have games that matter, because that game didn't matter. So Wenger coming into the press conference and saying, blaming the referee, what the heck, man? You lost 10-2. 10-2. I don't, you know what? That first leg, you can just say you lost it right then. You were never going to beat Bayern Munich 5-1 at home, even 11-on-11. Arsenal played well, yes. They you know what? Lauren Koscielny's plus-minus numbers, off the charts. In case anybody's wondering, Arsenal lost 9-0 while Koscielny was not on the field. They were up 2-1 while he was on. That's 53 minutes the first game, and I believe 49 minutes the second game. It's so the majority of those two legs, Koscielny was on there, and they were winning 2-1 in aggregate. He goes off, they're down 9-0. Granted, you know, some of those came with them at 10 men. Still, the problem is still the same. It's right now there's a disconnect between Arsene Wenger and the fans. He doesn't understand. Any fan, if I'm an Arsenal fan, and Alex, you can speak to it, but I think you've already spoken to it a little bit, to hear your manager, after you lose the worst loss that you've ever had at home in a European competition, in aggregate 10-2, to come out and blame the referee, that's silly. It's completely silly.
I'll go on another rant here, and I've said this a few times on Twitter. I think Laurent Koscielny, if he weren't on Arsenal, he'd be considered one of the best central defenders in the world. But because there's such a clown show going on around him half the time, he doesn't get that credit. But he's a wonderful defender, and he has been for half a decade. I mean, years ago, he was one of the few guys who actually succeeded at slowing down Messi and even shutting him out for entire games. But as for Arsenal as a whole, I think we've once again arrived at the point where Arsenal needs to decide if they're a competitive sports club or if they're a business. Because they're not run like a team that's trying to win things. They're run like a business. They have to break even. They have to, you know, make sure they get in the Champions League because of the money, not because that's where the glory is won. And you know, Wenger is like a good middle manager. You know, he delivers a positive bottom line. He never goes over budget. He sort of keeps the peace on in the office. And they just kind of amble on and on and on. And I think that comes back to the ownership, you know, the American Stan Kroenke and Usmanov, I think his name is, the other majority owner, just don't seem terribly bothered about how they actually do so long as their asset is appreciating. I mean, there's not that Roman Abramovich fire where, you know, they lose a few games and he's furious and he's thinking, who can I hire and who's going to fix this for me? I need to win more games. And, you know, there's credit to Arsenal for being fiscally responsible because more clubs in soccer probably should be. But it's when they're being frugal the way they have been for year after year after year and say, we have no money, even though Arsenal is actually the seventh richest club in the world and has the highest average season ticket price in the world, even though that's not a major part anymore of the way soccer teams earn money, but they have money and they really have never had an excuse not to spend it and to put more good players around guys like Ozil and Alexis Sanchez. If they're ever going to win and break out of this cycle, they need to not just dump Arsene Wenger, but they need to really back the next manager with the kind of money he needs.
So Arsenal right now, they have a game in hand in the Premier League. They're 2 points out of the fourth spot behind Liverpool. But, you know, it just seems like going by what happened against Bayern that the players aren't going to fight for Wenger. That I think it's assuming a lot that, you know, what happened in the Champions League isn't going to carry over to what's going on, will affect their chances of finishing top four again, which always keeps Wenger in good graces with the board because they get the Champions League money. And as Leander said, the club is very much run like a business. But going back to the scene yesterday, it seems like it calls out for something that the club must, in order to salvage the season, do they announce that, make it finally the final decision that Wenger is gone at the end of the season? They, you know, reportedly still have that contract out, contract extension for Wenger. It doesn't seem like Wenger can go on at that club. It just they're at this. It's this crossroads where the club needs to finally decide what they're going to do with Arsene Wenger. Because if they side with furthering this business model, which works great for the club's finances, but the club and the supporters for so long have been crying out for change, for something different. And I think the club needs to do something about it because that was not a great scene. That was not a great look for the club yesterday.
Yeah, round of 16 exit for the seventh year in a row.
But the manner of the exit, I think, is what's making it so untenable, that it's a 10-2 demolition. And, you know, we always talk about Arsenal and fiscal responsibility, but Bayern Munich exemplifies how a club can be fiscally responsible and still be successful. That club is run completely in the black, and you know, their lowest season ticket amounts to, I think, about $10 a game. So the two need not be mutually exclusive, but I do think that Wenger's situation has past the point of being untenable. And I think that there's probably a better chance than ever before that he maybe won't be there next season. But that said, there's still a really good chance he just will be because he seems to be just immune to the criticism or able to just tune it out and make it not matter to him.
He has full control. He's not going to leave unless he wants to leave is what it's come down to at this point because the supporters have made their views very clear over the years at various points. But at the end of the day, it all comes back down to Arsene. If he wants to do it, there's a contract waiting for him whenever he wants to sign it. And every year he chooses to sign it, and so they go. I do think that as much as you would say that there's a benefit to announcing that he's not coming back, Is there really? I mean, it's just all it's going to do is spark up rumors on who's going to replace Arsene, who can replace Arsene Wenger. And the names that are going to come up are probably all employed for the most part. You know, Massimiliano Allegri is one of the names that comes up. He's in the Champions League fighting with Juventus. You're probably not going to hear him say, I'm going to go to Arsenal. And if there's no actual announcement on who his replacement is going to be, if it's not like a Pep Guardiola type of situation, then all you're going to have is people talking about the fact that this is a club running on autopilot with no captain ready to take over. And you're sitting there wondering what's going to happen with the club. It might even devolve into more chaos than already exists, which the Alexis situation, although it's extremely chaotic and really disheartening if you're an Arsenal fan since he's your best player, it still has Arsene technically in charge in the sense that he's still willing to bench the guy for the first half against Liverpool. He's still willing to take him off in the Champions League when there's really no reason for him to be on there. But it's still a man who has some form of power and authority. And at the end of the day, if they want to sell Alexis for 40, 50 million, whatever, this summer, they can still do that and reinvest the money somewhere else. If you announce Arsene's gone, then what is the strategy? Who knows the strategy? Is there even a person who's running the show anymore? It's one of those weird things. I think ideally he would say, I will reconsider my position here, but regardless of what happens, I'll still stay on as a technical director, because I think most people are okay with him being in that type of role as long as he stops managing. So I think that this is the time to change. I'm just not necessarily sure there's a benefit to announcing the change right away.
It's unfortunate, though, because I think that Arsene Wenger has ceased to be a sympathetic character. And I think a few years ago, people did feel for Wenger. They thought, okay, the club is hamstrung for money, and Wenger's still delivering these top four finishes. And not very long ago, Wenger could have left Arsenal and walked into a top job at Barcelona or PSG. And I don't know if he could walk into a top job if he left Arsenal now. I don't know how many clubs like that would want him.
I disagree slightly that you wouldn't want to dump him now or announce that he'll be leaving at the end of the season, because the way modern soccer works is, you know, the transfers for the summer, especially among coaches, are sort of being worked out now, even if they're not being announced necessarily. I think any manager that's looking to move on over the summer, like someone like Allegri, is his agent's going to be working the phones now and sort of trying to get him lined up somewhere, which is why news of Guardiola going to a new team always seems to leak around this time of year or be announced after a leak. At the same time, if you wait to the summer, if you don't get Alexis Sanchez renewed until the summer, he knows he's got a year left on his deal and he has all the leverage and he can force through a transfer if he wants to. If you tell him now, look, Wenger's going, I know you guys don't get along anymore, we'd like you to stay, we're going to have a new manager in the summer, you'll get some input, you might have a much better chance of keeping him with a fat new contract now than you would if you wait until the summer. Also, I don't really know about keeping Wenger on as a technical, because clearly he makes some strange choices as a manager. But he also is the guy that's always kind of running the transfer budget as if he's working for some small second division French club, you know, bringing in young players just to try to avoid spending heavily and developing them. He's never really spent like a big club probably should. I mean, yes, he splashed out for Sanchez and Ozil, but he very rarely has done it for enough players in a single cycle of team building for it to make a difference in the last decade or so. So, you know, I don't know that he's the right man even for that job. I think you probably want a clean break. Otherwise, you have a Manchester United type of situation where Sir Alex Ferguson still kind of looms over everything.
Well, it could be a big problem, too, because if Sanchez does leave, which it seems almost certain he will, you know, in today's market, the kind of money that the club would need to replace a player like that, I just don't know if Arsene Wenger has it in him to spend that kind of money.
So in addition to Bayern Munich and Barcelona going through to the last eight, were Real Madrid, where they beat Napoli 3-1 in Naples to go through 6-2 on aggregate, and Borussia Dortmund, as we expected, cruised past Benfica 4-0 in their second leg win to go through 4-1 on aggregate. Christian Pulisic, guys heard of him? He had a goal and assist in the Dortmund win. That was the American teenager's first ever Champions League goal. But the story for Tuesday was Sergio Ramos coming to the rescue yet again for Real Madrid. And Shahan, you have some incredible stats on just how amazing Ramos has been for Real.
Yeah, I saw this, and I'll give credit to Reddit actually had this. It said, of Sergio Ramos' 21 goals since the 2014 Champions League final, 18 have come when Real Madrid are losing or tied. And wow. we have a colleague here at Yahoo, and when we were watching the Real Madrid game, he looked up and said, El minuto 90 y Ramos, which means translates to the minute 90 and Ramos, because he is the clutch player for Real Madrid. You know, it's that stat is staggering. I mean, we're talking about a defender scoring that many goals, first of all. He had a brace yesterday on Tuesday, and Napoli actually looked like the better side. They were creating some really good chances, and then Ramos pops up on a corner, header, goal, and you're like, oh, they're not going to do this, are they? And then he pops up again, second goal, and you're like, all right, that tie is done then. And it was Ramos almost single-handedly killing off the tie, which for a defender to do that when you know that he's that dangerous in the air is, I mean, it's remarkable. It, you know what, hats off to him. You know, for all the times that he's gotten red cards, and there have been many, and it's seemingly always happened in Clasicos or big games. You know, there's one thing that you can say about Sergio Ramos that you can't always say about Arsenal is that he cares. And it comes across in goals when they're down or tied. He seems to pop up because he cares. When he gets those red cards, it's generally because his team has just blown up something and he's trying a little bit too hard. And it is something that it's really difficult to pinpoint. But I would say that Sergio Ramos tends to care more than most people when it comes to playing the game, because he does give it his all. And it kind of shows up in these type of little goals that really do make a difference. And obviously in the Champions League final when he scored that header, that, I mean, without them, Atletico Madrid wins. That's that. So, you know, hats off to Sergio Ramos. But I will say, definitely give a proper shout out to Dries Mertens, who showed why he's been so good. You know, there were a couple of postage attempts in that second leg as well. One from Real Madrid, but Mertens almost had it where Napoli was up 2-0 and you were sitting there going, ooh, they're ahead on away goals. And then, you know, Ramos popped up and that's just how it went.
Can't disagree with that.
Anyone else?
Sergio Ramos scores late goals and get red cards. Yes, yes, I 100% endorse that statement.
One thing, you know, while we're on the Real Madrid topic, I will say Real Madrid is in great position right now. You know, and at the end of the day, when you look at them entering the quarterfinals, you know, Bale is back fit, Ronaldo and Benzema are healthy, Modric looks good, Toni Kroos looks good, Casemiro's back healthy. Varane was suspended, but, you know, he's available. Ramos is there, Pepe is there. Seemingly everybody's healthy. Then you look at guys off the bench like Morata, Kovacic, Lucas Vazquez, who can't even get a run in the game, really. And then it really is an embarrassment of riches. And then, you know, you also have Marcelo and Danny Carvajal, who's been playing really well. When you look at their numbers 1 through 11, and shout out to Keylor Navas as well, but when you look at them put a team out on the pitch, it's there really are no weaknesses out there.
When Mertens scored, you would expect Real Madrid, as the game started, he scored in the 24th minute, as the game went on, that you would sense a little panic, you know, see a little bit of panic in Real Madrid, but they're the champions. It was almost effortless, like inevitable that they were going to come back. That,
yeah, Zidane.
There was no panic at all in that team. They stuck to it. Ramos gets that first goal. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't workmanlike. It seemed like it was effortless for them to go through 3-1, 6-2.
Got the feeling they had another gear to go to.
Yeah,
if need
exactly.
Be, and they didn't really need to do it. They could just stay sort of in second cruise.
For as much as we built up Napoli going into the round of 16, how great they were playing, you know, Real Madrid seemed like they were in control for both legs.
And you know, the score shows it. I mean, there was 3-1 in the first leg, 3-1 in the second leg. And they deserved it. I mean, the second one leg, you could say they were outplayed for a good portion of it, but they got the result, and good teams do that. They get the result away from home. They did their real business at home. They dominated that first leg. There's really just no reason to count Real Madrid not as one of the favorites at this point. And they look better and better and healthier than they have really all season. They're getting to full strength. And, you know, Zidane after the match actually said there was we were never really worried. When you're away from home, you get a goal scored and you're one goal away from going out, to have that type of confidence speaks volumes, and it starts with the manager.
Leander, you wrote about Pulisic getting his first Champions League goal, and really that was the goal that, if you want to go, it clinched Dortmund's spot in the quarterfinals.
No homer. Zero homerism on this show. Zero homerism.
Even though, well, sidebar, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang had a hat trick. Oh, well.
Just a hat trick.
But American.
Let's quickly talk about Pulisic. Look, he was already going to be selected by Bruce Arena for the upcoming World Cup qualifiers for the U.S. men's national team against Honduras. But for the confidence of a kid, I mean, talk about the significance of, for a young teenager, American teenager, coming with a big goal in a big game and arguably the biggest stage for soccer.
Well, that's the amazing thing about him. He's 18 years old now, and he has probably already had the most consequential European club career of any American. In the sense that at a higher stage, he has already done more than anybody else. Yes, Clint Dempsey scored a lot of goals in the Premier League, and he got Fulham into the Europa League final. But this is the Champions League, and Pulisic, even though I don't think that's how they pronounce it in Croatia, but okay. You know, he got that flicked-on header in the fourth minute for Aubameyang, which tied up the entire contest with Benfica. Dortmund, by the way, had really dominated the first leg in Lisbon, but Kostas Mitroglou, the Khal Drogo of soccer, had you know, poked in a little goal, and Benfica had somehow snuck away with the 1-0 lead after the first leg. Dortmund have been very frustrated, but so they get the early equalizer from Aubameyang, and then it takes until the 59th minute for them to get their winner. And Lukas Piszczek had a beautiful through ball, sort of disguised it, made it look like something else for Pulisic. Who did a nice job of staying onside, and then he had this great little first time chip over the goalkeeper, and it was just such a mature goal. And it was, you know, he's playing soccer at a level that no American has ever played, and he's 18 years old. And of course, this is all pretty nicely timed, considering that the Americans have their World Cup qualifiers at the end of the month.
Yeah, it is Pulisic, because I've heard him say Pulisic, and as much as how they pronounce it in Croatia, I can speak from experience, Mr. Sherlockins, that my name in, you know, if we were going to Arabic, my last name would be Ahmed.
Ahmed.
I'm not from there. I'm from, you know, Pakistan or Pakistan. Over there, they say Ahmed. In America, I say Ahmed. So how you say your name is how what your name
You're
is.
You're listening to the linguistics podcast.
I'm just making it clear that if he says Pulisic, and I've heard him say Pulisic, it's Pulisic.
I used to get mad when teachers used to pronounce my last name Lego.
I would be mad too, because your teachers couldn't read.
Before we get out of here, we're gonna devote our last 5 minutes, hopefully, to Major League Soccer for our commitment to MLS.
All right, see you guys later.
Let's start with you, Leander. What was your big takeaway from the opening weekend of MLS?
Oh wow, put me on the spot. Why don't you?
Yes.
One of the big things for me was that it's still hard being an expansion team. As we could see, I thought Atlanta United, they were really impressive in their first half against the New York Red Bulls. And the New York Red Bulls, let's not forget, have won the Eastern Conference regular season for 3 out of the last 4 years. You know, so to do what they did right off the bat and really outplay the Red Bulls. Oh, Shahan's actually leaving.
He just got up and walked away.
To outplay the Red Bulls the way they did for a lot of that game was deeply impressive. And Tata Martino, clearly, we already knew, was a very good coach. But, you know, there's a long history of accomplished foreign coaches floundering in MLS. But it's going to be really interesting what they do over there. New York was lucky to get those two goals and to come back in that game. You know, the other expansion team, of course, Minnesota, got absolutely tonked 5-1 by the Portland Timbers, which won the title 2 years ago and then missed the playoffs last year in the loaded Western Conference. They clearly have a long ways to go. But one of the things for me, and again, I'll defer to Alex here, was the Galaxy getting pretty well outplayed, I think, by FC Dallas.
Yeah. I was at the game, and, you know, I think we've seen the Galaxy better, of course, but You also got to give a hand to Dallas. And I think the last couple of seasons, we've got into the season talking about Dallas as one of the best teams. And I think, again, they showed us that they pretty much are. I mean, that's a Dallas team that's pretty much the finished article versus a Galaxy team that's very much a work in progress. You know, there were some good things about it. I thought that, you know, it's nice to see Yelly Van Damme at the back of center of defense. I thought Jermaine Jones was all over the place, but not in a bad way. I liked the way he was just popping up everywhere. But I would have liked to have seen more from Giovanni Dos Santos, who I think this is definitely an opportunity for this to be his team right now. And he has the talent to be kind of a Giovinco type player. And I didn't really see it from him in that game, nor did I see much from Alessandrini, aside from the pat that I can't tell apart from Sebastian Legette.
He wears 7 and Legette wears 17.
Oh, that makes it
easier.
And so
when I was watching the game, I couldn't see the 1 for Legette. And I thought that was Alessandrini.
They're dead ringers for
amazing,
each other.
Amazing doppelganger.
Yeah.
My big takeaway, other than just being impressed by the crowd at Bobby Dodd Stadium, the 55,000 that sold out the Atlanta United opener, that was impressive. It was so loud. You can really sense it while watching on TV, like how
that's cool,
how intense, how fun of an atmosphere it was. And, you know, hopefully that continues. They have 30,000 season tickets sold for the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Hopefully that enthusiasm and that vibe translates over to, what is it, a dome, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of hard to do. But, you know, with the young DPs, the South American DPs that they brought in, Miguel Almiron and Josep Martinez, they were very impressive. And as Lena was saying, for the first 70 or so minutes, they were the better side against the Red Bulls. My big takeaway, I was surprised at how well Houston played with their new look under Wilmer Cabrera. Kubo Torres, who has not done anything as a DP for Houston until this past weekend, he scored the opener, and that was against the champion Sounders. They won 2-1. Clint Dempsey was back, and he scored. But it's pretty impressive for a Dynamo squad who's really kind of been forgotten. You know, they've been there before. They've won MLS Cups before. The franchise has. So
two finals in a row not very long ago.
Yeah, it's good. It was good to see them, you know, take a step forward back into what they, you know, they've been a proud club in MLS. The Galaxy, I was a little hard on them. I know they had some starters missing, but full credit to FC Dallas. Kellen Acosta with that the winner. I think he's going to take somebody's spot on the U.S. men's national team squad when Bruce Arena calls in guys for the World Cup qualifying. He's playing too well. He's for him not to be chosen. And, yeah, that's it for our MLS 5 minutes.
So, Sean, you can come back now.
that'll wrap up this podcast. Please go to iTunes and review our podcast.
And subscribe. Also, like us on Facebook. You can find us by just going to the URL facebook.com/FCYahoo.
And with that, thanks, guys. For Shahan Ahmed, Alex Baker, Leander Charlakins, I'm Joe Lago. This has been the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.
I have so much love for Cavani. All right, moving on.